right, we are back with an all-new Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
And that's just not important right now because I'm Louis Fertel, and we have with us a reality TV goddess.
All right.
Ma'am. Ma'am. Nope. Sandra.
Parvati's here?
Kind of.
Yeah, sure. The Parvati of Crooked Media is here.
It's okay. Wow. You said it, not us. We can disagree later, Ira. It's John Lovett.
Hi.
Who does podcasts here.
You bet.
But also. Was on the show Survivor.
I was.
And you were mysteriously, lovingly, I would say, eliminated first.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to watch it live with a bunch of gay people at High Tops.
That's
in
right.
the East Side,
That's
which was
right.
a pleasure to see.
Mm-hmm.
But man, what a journey. And you've already talked about it some, but now we're going to get nasty about it.
Okay, let's do it.
First of all, let's just talk about how surprised were you to get eliminated? How surprised?
Oh, so I was not surprised at all.
Yeah.
I really wasn't. It wasn't surprising. What actually was very hard was in the hours leading up to it was trying to figure out how to get out of what I felt like was an unstoppable situation because I think part of why I was a little bit nervous, more than nervous. I was dreading a bit what it was going to be like once it aired, in part because I had no idea how I'd be presented. And I had no idea if how it felt to be in it is what it would look like when it was on screen. But it is. And basically, somebody had a bit of a meltdown.
He sure did.
And
one of the most memorable, I'm not a Survivor aficionado, but that has to be one of the craziest meltdowns in the history of the show, especially for episode one.
And I had thought about what it would be like for someone on my tribe to have a meltdown. And I thought about what it would be like for someone to turn on me. I didn't see them happening at the exact same moment. And it really created a challenge. So in the new era of Survivor, there's something called a shot in the dark. And what a shot in the dark is every person basically has a roll of the dice. If you think you're on the chopping block, if you think you're going to be eliminated, you can roll this dice and you have a 1 in 6 chance of getting to stay. Everybody has it. And you lose your vote. But that 1 in 6 chance means that other people don't want you to know if the vote is on you, right? It used to be that there were votes in Survivor where they would just say, Louis, I'm really sorry, but we're voting for you. Ira and I talked about it and you're done. If you didn't have an idol, that was it. You were done. They don't do that anymore. It makes it more interesting to watch. But what I hadn't really anticipated was what happens when a bunch of people decide that because someone had this implosion, they're really not a threat anymore. So they're going to tell you that because of the implosion, they're voting for that person. But really, they're voting for you because you're a little bit more dangerous. How do you persuade someone to vote for the person they're telling you they're going to vote for?
Right.
So everyone is telling me that the vote is on Andy. And I just, gut feeling in that moment, just didn't believe it. So I spent a while trying to figure out how do you make that true. That felt more and more impossible. So you're trying to quickly figure out some other path, some other vote. If Andy hadn't had that meltdown, I think the vote probably goes a completely different direction. But because it did, I really didn't have a lot of options. And so I went into Tribal basically feeling like I had a 1 in 6 chance with a shot in the dark. I probably had about a 1 in 6 chance with the vote. I decided to go with my vote because if I had persuaded people to come along with me, I would have voted myself out by using the shot in the dark.
Right.
And so I really was thinking right before the vote, like, do I just dump my bag out, take out my shot in the dark and play it in front of everybody, which would have been really funny. But I decided not to because I really did think there was a chance that I'd had gotten enough people to vote with me. In the end, I didn't, which is why I wasn't really surprised. But it was sort of the opposite of a blindside, I'd say.
Shot in the dark, great Peter Sellers picture. Mm. Second of all.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, it was fascinating to watch this one episode. But also, I had just thought in general, I was like, how will John Lovett do on this show? And I will say, every option to me seemed available. I never thought you were like definitely counted out or whatever. Other than, it's the gift of so many Survivor players that play again and again that they just, for whatever reason, do not seem devious or calculating. And I just think when you're a podcaster and you have to think on your feet all the time, there's a general deviousness seeming quality about you, you know?
Yeah, and I think probably, like, in fair, like, I think there probably were moments, especially in the hours leading, like, people have asked, like, oh, well, why didn't you try this or why didn't you try that? Like, I tried a bunch of different things that you don't see, which obviously they're not, like, the edit is completely fair. I was trying a bunch of different things in the run up to the vote. And in the end, those are things people could use against you because, you know, you're trying to throw the vote somewhere else. Really, like the way the tribe ended up breaking down, I had really had a good connection with Annika in the first like 24 hours. By happenstance, we didn't really talk much. It ended up just naturally being Sierra and Sam, Rachel and Annika, me and Andy. Had Andy not fallen apart the way he did, I think there was a way for us to pull in Annika and Rachel. But because of what happened and because Rachel had already, I think, been a bit suspicious of Andy, it just made it very difficult. I just didn't have a lot of room to maneuver. And they show part of the conversation, but I really did sit for like 15 or 20 minutes speaking, like just talking out loud to the camera. Like, I could try this, I could try that, I could do this, I could do that. I could try to get Sam and Andy to vote with me on Annika, try to pull Sierra in. I could try to go back to Rachel and Annika to vote for Sierra. Like, all of these things were contemplated. I was really trying to work every piece of it. And because it was so early, everybody's just looking for something they can count on. Right.
Yes. Like
none of us really know each other that well. None of us have been through a vote. None of us really know who they can trust. And I think the throwing my name out there, it just became this this sort of snowball rolling down the hill. I just couldn't stop it.
Yeah, it stops the conversation. It's like, all right, we've made a decision. It's over. Ira, what did you think of this episode and moment in television history?
Oh, yes, the Survivor Watcher. Love it. Question for you, actually, mm-hmm. as a person who loves Survivor and a person who's seen how this new era has sort of shaken out for people, do you sort of think that for people going into a new tribe, especially the way, you know, you got attached to Andy, and so it was sort of like, well, let's get rid of him. And then part of it was also, I saw like the beginning of the episode, you know, you sort of felt a little bit on the outs with them because you were like, well, I'm older than them. You know, they're talking about Vine. I missed Vine. You know, you're trying to connect with them through TikTok. Do you think it's more beneficial when you jump in to maybe just sort of try and lay a groundwork immediately with a lot of different people than try to latch onto one person? Because there was the one weird moment, and maybe that's just the edit, but I remember when you did walk off with Andy, like there was the comment like, oh, they're walking off together. So I feel like, are you immediately seen as a duo if you walk somewhere with someone?
So I've thought about this. Like the social dynamics are what they are. You kind of can go back and look, say, were there dynamics here at play that maybe led to this? And maybe they did. But the reality is you don't need any of the social pieces to strategically figure out why what happened, right?
Like, of course.
And so are there social layers to it? Absolutely. But I really do think it was a strategic decision. Andy had mm-hmm. kind of exposed himself to all the tribes mm-hmm. as being somebody unreliable and ultimately weak in like kind of as a player and like kind of a little bit off. And so he became somebody kind of, he rendered himself a bit harmless. If there was a mistake, I decided going into it, like I could try to hide or I could just be myself, thinking that basically like, if you're spending time with me, I'm going to come across as myself. Like I'm not going to be able to hide that I'm just not gonna be able to not make jokes. I'm gonna be myself. It's gonna come. And I thought like, oh, what am I gonna do? Like pretend to be somebody else or like not like do what I would do in having a normal conversation. I thought that I would come across even weirder if I tried something like that. And so I think there was just no way for me not to seem as a threat. There are conversations that you don't see where I basically tried to convey to members of the tribe that like, hey, like I wanna go far with you. Like I want to be someone that helps you go far in the game. Like I want to help you. I want to be somebody as a sounding board to think strategically through the game. And I think people were open to that. It wasn't like that wasn't valid. It was just that in the moment there became a choice between me or Andy, and I would have made the same choice. Why on earth would you not keep Andy after what happened? That just made a lot of sense.
Do you think it's like now beneficial, I don't know, going into Survivor now to just sort of like, I don't know, almost have like sort of a meltdown or a weak moment on the show? I mean, we saw this with Banu, you know? I mean, do you think this is a moment where now players going into the show now are sort of, with all of the twists and turns, they're not playing like they used to, and now it's sort of like, we want to sort of keep a weaker person around. So are people going to start trying to, I don't know, themselves as weak?
I don't know. I really don't know how strategically you think about, like, I don't know how you strategically think about somebody who, I think what was so difficult about it is that, like, I get further in the game, people will try anything to stay and just try to get to the next vote. But what it really felt like in the moment was somebody basically giving up a chance to win. Just like basically saying, it's day three. Mm-hmm. It is literally the first challenge, immunity mm-hmm. challenge. And you're basically saying, I can't win this game anymore, but God, I want to stay.
That's right? Fair. Like,
and so what happens if a bunch of people do that, or that becomes something people mm-hmm. try, or becomes kind of a move? I don't know, because moves... The validity of a move and whether it makes it possible or impossible for you to win is determined by the people watching it unfold. And if somebody were to say, I strategically pretended to be weak to get further in the game, like, is that valuable? Does that people believe that that's a worthy move? It really is like almost like it's about the evolving culture of Survivor.
He was so erratically behaved from the jump, though, like from Jeff's initial saying hi to him, that I kind of want him to be a, like, Kaiser Soze verbal Kent situation. Like, yeah. It was so fast how much you were like, this is bad news, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
His hi, Jeff, even in the middle of his breakdown, was so funny to me. And I don't know. I just think that I'm not one of those morality players, like, or like who deserves like to win in like Big Brother or like Survivor. Like, I think like play whatever game you need to play, like however you get there. It's why I love fucking Angela on Big Brother, this psycho. This
yeah, she is
right
still
now.
There. Yes.
But I don't know. There is just something about old school Survivor where I feel like if you were at that final tribal council, and that's where I felt bad for you, actually did feel bad for John Lovett. I felt like old school Survivor, you would have been able to sit there at tribal and say, he's basically giving up. I want to play this game. And the rest of the tribe would have voted him out, because at least in earlier Survivor, it was about, we're all here to play a game. And if someone is giving up, essentially, they don't want them to partake in the game anymore.
Yeah, and I it's hard to remember, but like I do think part of the challenge too is like there was a little bit of that conversation in tribal council, right? Like that's what you're mm-hmm. saying. That's like when Jeff goes to me and I say, like, when there seems to be a natural target, who's the unnatural target? That was basically after a bunch of people are talking about why Andy's giving up. Or Andy's not, he didn't really give up. His sort of whatever mm-hmm. meltdown or sort of breakdown was so damaging to the tribe, and how you couldn't, there was just a bunch of conversations making all of those arguments. But because of Shot in the Dark, mm-hmm. you're like, well, that means it's not going to be him. So that means the vote is still on me. But because of the conversations I'd had with Sam and with Andy, so here was what's happening. And here's another reason why I didn't play the Shot in the Dark. Going into tribal, If the vote had shifted to one mm-hmm. of the other targets that wasn't me and that wasn't Andy, you would have expected everyone to pretend the vote was still on Andy. That's what Sam would have done. That's what Andy would have done. Mm-hmm. That's what would have happened. And so it was really hard to know in the moment, did the vote shift off of me or is it still on me? And I just didn't know. There was no way to know for sure.
I was touched to hear that you learned most about the game, you said, in the Ponderosa part of the show where you're eliminated and then the other eliminated contestants come in one by one. What did you glean from that?
So here's what's really interesting about it is when you get eliminated, look, imagine you both open your calendar and put in March of next year, there's going to be a night where everybody thinks I'm dumb. You know, like that's mm-hmm. a weird thing to know that's coming. And so from the moment you're eliminated, maybe you're a bit in shock, maybe you're disappointed or angry or whatever set of emotions you have, but you haven't really yet had the time to build the story you want to tell about what happened. Like, as we're talking about this right now, I am telling a story. It is, I believe, probably as accurate a story as I can convince myself is the truth while protecting my ego in ways subtle and less subtle.
Very like, Joan Didion, yes.
But when someone's eliminated, for that first couple of hours, they're not able to do that yet. They're kind of casting about for what happened, what went wrong, who hurt them, who lied to them, who tricked them, who supported them, who backed them, all this stuff. And so they come into Ponderosa and they just talk for like 2 hours. And you just get this sense of, before they've had a chance to protect themselves, of what really happened. And whether they mean to or not, you see like, oh, I see what happened, right? I kind of see mm-hmm. where they went wrong. Even if you don't point it out, you're like, oh, that sounds like you're describing somebody who was annoyed by you, or it sounds like you alienated yourself, whatever it may be. And person after person comes down and does this. And I just sort of decided, like, I chose to go on Survivor. It couldn't be more extracurricular. Couldn't have been more of a decision. So I'm not going to be negative or mad in this time. I'm just going to use this as an opportunity. I'm going to enjoy the fact that I am in Fiji, and I'm going to learn what people have to say about what it was like for them to play this game. And that was really fascinating. Just it was really fascinating.
And of course, you may end up being on The Amazing Race with, oh, Ira? I have no idea.
I think we'd kill each other. No. It's Traitors next.
Oh, of course. That's exactly what you should do. The Emmy-winning Traitors.
Emmy Award-winning Traitors.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, you are a really good storyteller. I think Jeff Probst said that about you. And I loved your Rob Has a Podcast episode. And
well,
I think
thank
that you.
You
are, yeah. I think that maybe that's honestly coming from what you learned from the people coming in the Ponderosa, but you're very smart about the game. You had very great, you know, confessionals, and, you know, it's sad that you didn't get further, but, you know.
Thank you for saying that. I know that there are ways I could have played differently and stayed in.
Been a comp beast, you know.
It's a comp beast.
Like a competition
been
beast.
Been great at competitions, yeah.
Sure.
Just they were kind of like, we won't win competitions without you, with him in the game.
Yeah, I think that was a way of, that was a face-saving way to describe keeping the person who had the meltdown.
Right,
I'm not,
yes.
This was not about who could lift a fucking thing. But I do think that, like, because of the way it went down, like, I don't feel regret about it because, like, I don't feel like I fucked up my experience. I feel like I didn't get the full experience. So I'm more disappointed than I am embarrassed. And what's been really tough, the hardest part about it has not been, I thought, I don't mind how they edited. I've trusted the edit and I felt validated by that. It's that people were so excited that I was on it.
Mm.
It's the opportunity cost. It's the episodes that didn't happen. It was the fun we didn't get to have. That's the part that really bumps me out. It's people being like, oh, I was so excited that you were on the show and I was so bummed that you got out first. Like, their reaction was more than I expected. I expected people to be meaner, frankly. And it just makes me like, oh, wow, like this was, like, the reason I went on was not wrong. Like, it would have been such a good fucking time to watch this unfold. So that's the part that makes me bummed, but I don't feel bad about anything that unfolded.
Again, I don't know what your ambitions are in this arena, but I have the feeling your reality TV days are not over. So, I mean, like, I think you will get a hobby. Yes, right.
Yeah.
I want to see Alan Cumming tangle with you, like, play the bagpipes in your face.
Hell yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I feel so bad, you know, that Travis and I said, first boot, definitely. And it turned out to be true.
All right. Fuck you, Ira. Bye, everybody. So fun. Love, keep it.
All right, well, the tribe has spoken
loudly.
Once again. So let's get back to our real show. Once again, I'm Ira Madison III.
I think I'm still Louis Fertel after all that, yes.
Yeah, and that was our guest for the episode, by the way. So I hope you had fun with him.
Right. If you want to hear him talk at any other time, I have no idea how you can do that. Maybe try online.
Honestly, I would do The Amazing Race. Would love it.
That literally, among all competitions on television, The Amazing Race is what I would be the worst at.
Really? Why so?
I have no sense of lateral spatial direction, and I don't trust people who do. Why do people have a natural understanding of how to get around Florence if they've not been there before?
That's fair.
You're like a bat or something. What's wrong with you?
But no, I think I would have more fun playing against him on Traitors.
That's fun. Also, Traitors is a game where, well, like Big Brother, frankly, people are obsessed with what makes a good player. And they're like, this person secretly was great. And this, it really comes down to some bullshit luck, honestly.
It does.
I think, you know, and like you say something amazing 1 minute and then the next minute they're all turning on you. It like, you think you can't prescribe a rubric of what actually makes a success on these shows. So, you know, someone like John Lovett shouldn't feel so bad about going home first on Survivor. There's plenty of other reasons you should feel bad.
Just feel a little bad.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Yeah. But also, I'm sorry, if I'm on Survivor and Jeff Probst is handing me a yellow bandana, I'm turning the other way. That tribe is cursed.
I have to say, I don't live for the physical challenges on Survivor. It feels like...
Really?
I mean, like, on Big Brother, they do updates of old games, and there's a lot of humor to them. So, like, there's a stupid gimmick or whatever that always makes it a little bit funnier than the last time you saw it. Whereas on Survivor, it's still the same adult Discovery Zone obstacle course every time. We're still dragging a barrel out of the sea.
I kind of think that, I mean, I love Australian Survivor, as we know, which the thing about that game is it's so much more brutal. And I really love those games. Sometimes I am a person who's like, okay, I don't really care about the physical competitions. But Australian Survivor, like, they are sort of like more strenuous and they're more fun and sort of innovative. And I think that, like, they need to spruce up the games a bit for US. Speaking of Australian Survivor, we're getting two new seasons next season. They're doing Brains versus Brawn again, but they're also doing Australia versus the World. And we got a sneak peek of some of the cast members for next season. And they're bringing back Australian faves like King George and Shawnee and Kirby from last season. But we will also be seeing Sariplay again. Mm. We will also be seeing Tony Vlachos. And we will also be seeing Parvati play.
Okay, at this point, Parvati, amount of hours logged on TV, it's like she's up there with like Carol Burnett and Dick Van Dyke. Like, it's like so deep and long. And Sheree, of course, who won the first season of The Traitors. And one of the most, I'm not going to call it shocking, fabulous wins on a reality show I've ever seen.
That was a better win for me because, I mean, I feel like those bitches are still pressed that she won.
Also, it's just...
They're angry.
I get that it's probably... The game is extremely personal when you play it or whatever, and so things feel really heated and intense and directly personal. But they were ridiculous. I can't imagine not taking a step back and thinking, okay, ultimately we are at a weird mansion in Europe. Broadway's Alan Cumming is screaming orders at us. Take yourself less seriously.
The East Village's Alan Cumming.
Yes. Yeah, Club Cummings, Alan Cumming. What's going on this episode besides all that?
Besides all that, there's a lot going on this week.
No shit.
Unfortunately. Or fortunately? I don't know. My head's spinning kind of from all of the content. There is a lot going on with Chapel Roan again.
We'll get into her. Yes.
We'll get into her. There is trouble in the Rhythm Nation.
Maybe the most trouble yet. We need extra choreography on this. Paula, get back in here.
When we tell you later about what Janet said, you might think she's crazy, but she's serious.
Yeah, there's that.
Yeah.
But also, Katy Perry has a new album out, or does she? Because we'll never speak of it again. It seems like it's called 143. And then we'll talk a bit about the new movie, The Substance, which I am happy to say seems to be the main movie everybody is talking about, and I did not anticipate that for the career of Demi Moore at this... By the way, Demi Moore, as she says, during the introduction to the movie at AMC Theaters. Demi Moore. Let's make sure we all get that right. Demi Moore.
Very Demi Moore. Very mindful. Which, of course, Jim Fallon is the one who did that sketch with her.
Oh, yeah. Mm, that should have been us over at Hamill.
Honestly,
she lives in LA. Come on, traitor. Yeah.
Honestly, I feel like you're a little step above that in brow. Too highbrow. You're not too highbrow over at Kimmel. But I feel like Jimmy Fallon is more of the specific TikTok-y meme. It's like you're not doing TikTok dances.
No, he's like opening Play-Doh and throwing it out at the celebrities and stuff. You know? I say that affectionately. It's fun. That's about all that we're going to talk about today. We've already done so much. We're exhausted. We'll be right back with more Keep It. So much can change in 4 years. I mean, 4 years ago, we were all stuck inside watching Zoom reunions of old sitcom casts. So even if you think your voter registration from 2020 is up to date, it's important to check again.
Maybe you've moved. Maybe you've changed your name. Or maybe you've recently turned 18 and this will be your first time voting. All three of those have occurred.
This election is going to be so close, so every single vote is even more important. Are you registered? What about your friends and family? With Vote Save America, you can easily check your registration, apply for a mail-in ballot, and check important deadlines for your state. It only takes a minute and a few clicks. Check and see if you're ready to vote at votesaveamerica.com/vote.
This message has been paid for by Vote Save America. You can learn more at votesaveamerica.com, and this ad has not been authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee. Lovett has gone from the island of Fiji to the bridge of the USS Enterprise for Trek the Vote, a new Vote Save America star-studded live stream event to benefit Vice President Harris and Governor Walz.
Featuring Jonathan Frakes, Gates McFadden, Will Wheaton, Jonathan Del Arco, Jerry Ryan, Rosalind Chow, Tawny Newsom, whom we love, Eugene Cordero, Noelle Wells, whom I love, Star Trek Lower Decks creator Mike McMahon, and Crooked Zone, John Lovett.
Join in on Wednesday, October 2nd at 4 p.m. Pacific time for this one-night-only live stream, virtually or in person, by going to votesaveamerica.com/trek. This message has been paid for by Vote Save America. You can learn more at votesaveamerica.com, and this ad has not been authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee.
Save big on your next project at Menards. Check out our huge selection of Richmond water heaters. Whether it's electric or gas, tank or tankless, Menards has what you need in stock. Ensure that you have hot water for when you need it most with a new Richmond water heater from Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Quick question. Are you politically engaged and spiritually exhausted?
If you said yes to both, welcome home. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
And we're the hosts of Hysteria, the podcast for women who care about democracy, culture, and not losing their minds in the process.
We break down the news, call out the nonsense, and spotlight the women actually fighting back on Capitol Hill, in classrooms, and everywhere the stakes are high.
It's sharp, honest analysis featuring women's voices with humor and zero handholding.
Listen to Hysteria wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube.
Exciting music news coming to Keep It right now. Lady Gaga announced a new album.
And we knew it was coming, and there were rumors that it would in fact be called Harlequin, which is, you know, where the words Harley Quinn come from, the character she's playing in the upcoming Joker musical extravaganza. Or not. There's not music in it, actually, or whatever the PR is. But we are getting a new album from her. And the vibe so far is giving I'm Breathless music from and inspired by the film Dick Tracy or Prince on the Batman soundtrack. There's lots of variability about what this project could mean for her career. It could mean nothing, could be a spicy little something in the middle of it. Can't tell how much I'm looking forward to it yet, though.
I do not think Prince or Stephen Sondheim are involved.
I think she probably asked nicely at the crystal ball for them to join her.
Knowing her, she probably did.
Yeah, right. No, I'm saying.
I went to their crypts. I asked for help. No, but that is all to distract us from the fact that we are here to discuss Katy Perry's new album, 143, which came out. And honestly, I don't hate it.
I feel like I don't hate it either. It's not that I'm rooting. It's not like I'm anxiously putting on these tracks again. But I feel like the point of this album, which is low on huge pop hooks, low on it just doesn't compare to some of the other songs in her career that were like instant classics. But the album is called 143, which is beeper pager slang for I love you. And I feel like the vibe of the album is like light sentimentality with a pop beat behind it. Like, it's not going for pretension or wild swings that don't work out. So for it to be, like, the lowest rated album on Metacritic since 2011, as I saw one tweet say about it, feels a bit extreme to me. That said, it's not essential either. So I can see being dismissive of the album, but I do feel like people are a bit over the top.
Yeah, it feels a little bit like if she were a pop star who were famous in the 80s or 90s, then this were her 19th album, we wouldn't really be paying attention to it. But if you were a diehard fan, you would listen to it. And and maybe you'd casually turn it on and be like, oh, hey, there's a couple songs I really like on Katy Perry's latest album.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And by the way, I think Lifetimes has really grown on me. I think it's now like a, you know, a B plus single. It's again, not as good as something like Walking on Air that I really did love once upon a time. But, you know, it's not bad. I think the main problem with this album also is she herself, the vocal, does one thing from start to finish on this album. It feels very flat in terms of what she is delivering. And maybe it's lacking specifically in things like character and winking jokes, like outsized personality moments that we used to associate with Katy Perry. If anything, it feels like if you're going to make pop music now, it still feels like a lightly resigned, I'm turning 40 maturity album.
Which is annoying because she is a singer. She can sing. She can belt. You bring up Walking on Air, which has, you know, that amazing sort of LaBouche sound to it. And then you think of a song that really sort of hit me and grew on me too. I'm His, He's Mine.
Enjoyable.
The Crystal Waters sample. And that features Doechii. And it's sort of a ho-hum sample. But I enjoy the song quite a bit. Even though it doesn't hit the heights of Walking on Air, I feel like if you're going to sample a house track, you need to be wailing, you know? You need to give us something, a bit of a club banger. And I feel like that lane is really good for her, but she hasn't really ever leaned into it in a way that I feel like she should.
And I think what you're describing also, like how that sample is a little bit limp, I think people would describe ultimately this whole album as just limping in a bit. In a way, it feels like an album you put out to get through a record deal. You know, like technically these are all pop songs and they're like competently written, but they could also kind of be sung by anybody. And that's, I think, the worst thing I can say about this album is it sort of feels like someone dropped off 11 tracks at her door. You know, and she just said, she's like combing through them like, go, let's go, let's go. Even if they are sweet songs with some memorable hooks, the song Truth, not one of her best songs, still in my head a little bit. You know?
Oh, that's actually my favorite on the album.
Oh, okay.
I love that. I'm really like All the Love.
Good song.
And I like Gorgeous, but it's, you know, it's, I like Aaron Joseph's work, and he produced a lot of the songs on this, and he's largely been a Kim Petras producer. And obviously, some of these songs sound like they would probably be better if Kim Petras were singing them.
Well, let me just say also, Kim Petras has a lot of output we don't talk about either. And it feels like one of those albums a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, like one of the seven albums she puts out in a given year, the one that's like, you know, Slut Pop, Portland, Oregon, or the one you don't really listen to that much.
By the way, her Chainsmokers song is kind of a banger.
I agree. Also, unfortunately, I think the Chainsmokers have several bona fide pop classics. Just in terms of can't get them out of your head. I'm not saying it was justified when they were at number one for 18 weeks or whenever that was.
Also, she's apparently bona fiding one of them. So.
Are you Page Six? Who talks like this? You Variety in the 30s? Yeah.
Kim Petras steps out with the Chainsmokers. No, that's the Daily Mail. Listen, I think that the album is just sort of not deserving of the vitriol that it's getting. That's what I think the main conclusion that we're at here is, because, boy, the gays are ruthless. And too ruthless with this, and it's sort of become like hunting Katy Perry for sport at this point. And it's, okay, she's like, it's easy to make fun of her sometimes, but the jokes aren't that funny. And also the music isn't that bad for you to be dragging it like this.
I also just think she personally is not that bad. You know, it's just like, what are we so upset at? I don't know.
She killed a nun.
Yeah, right.
Who cares?
And it was funny at the time.
We love Catholicism all of a sudden.
Yeah. I ran away from that. Stop putting me back there.
Did we all miss Spotlight?
That taught you something, including which pants silhouettes Rachel McAdams should avoid. No, I agree. I mean, like, again, the lowest score on Metacritic for 15 years, it's not that bad. I will say, though, it is weird about music. Like, I think most critics know that even if they're listening to an album they don't particularly like, there's an understanding that it'll probably be music for somebody else. That's kind of different than movies, where if it's a failure, like tells a story poorly, you can basically pretend it's objective and say, well, this is a failure. And so you're likelier to give something like that a 0-star rating. Whereas music, I feel like you rarely give a bomb rating to because it's for somebody and there's less things you can mark against it. But I feel like what really leads to her being so poorly rated in this case is expectation. Like, okay, she has these banger albums and we're on the precipice always of her kind of coming back. You know, she's like never out of the game. She's still got American Idol, still making $20 million a year or whatever.
Yeah.
So it feels like she's primed for a big comeback moment. And then when you don't get it, I think you want to turn the switch the other way and say, well, that sucks. You know, we were anticipating something and didn't get it.
Well, I think part of it too is she is always preparing us for that. You know, it's sort of always acting like this is the big moment, as opposed to say, I don't know, Gwen Stefani is releasing an album soon, and like, who gives a fuck? If you're a Gwen Stefani fan who likes her current music, the Blake era, then it's probably for you. But if you're an old Gwen Stefani fan, if you love No Doubt, if you loved her first two albums, you're probably not going to even listen to it, right? But she is just sort of casually releasing music, and it's not really an event, right? But I feel like whenever Katy Perry drops a new album, there's always this huge rollout and this whole, like, here's a new era, KP, whatever number this is, 7?
Something like that, yeah.
It's always a big event, you know, and it's always this big promo, and then when the music doesn't match the buzz, then I feel like that is what makes reviewers, at least critics, a little angry with their pen. I do think that people are sort of rating this lower than they need to be rating it.
But speaking of which, the Gwen Stefani album, it is a little confusing because it's called Bouquet, and then she's holding one flower on the cover. Let's think about that for a moment. It's not the same thing. But if you look at the track listing, every, like, 6 or 7 of the tracks have a different flower in them, so that's where the term bouquet comes from. And I have to say, I applaud a literal album concept. We rarely get those anymore. Like when Olivia Newton-John released the physical album, and then all of the songs are called things like Tied Up or things involving physicality. Like, that's so old school showbiz, and I applaud that. So hopefully it'll be good. And I still like that Gwen Stefani song, Make Me Like You. So there's a chance she still got it.
Oh, I mean, that was a really great Target commercial.
Shot live at some awards show for $15 million. It's one of the most expensive music videos ever made.
Take that, Michael.
Yeah, right. Which reminds me, we should just move this along to the Keep It segment so we can get to the Jacksons. But anyway.
All right, I think that's it with Katy Perry, to be honest. I'm streaming, so shout out to her.
And again, if I haven't said this before, Billboard is doing a list of the top 25 pop stars of the 21st century, and she came in at 25. She should be top 10. It's an obnoxious listing. She's behind like so many people who aren't as significant in terms of radio airplay as she is. So that's my, we love you anyway, Katy Perry, sentiment of the day.
Where's Jelly Roll?
Still at the Emmys. Still telling you it's okay to be dead.
Geared up for the Oscars. A duet between Jelly Roll and her.
Oh, my God. I don't hate it. Actually, he seems kind of like a funny, nice guy.
Yeah. All right. When we're back, we're going to get into the substance. Summer is over, which means it is time to put away the popcorn flicks, and it's time for Lewis to stock up on Oscar movies to start his long winter hibernation.
I always forget. I dread summer being over, and then I realize, oh, I actually now get the entertainment I want. God is looking out for me. You ever think of it that way?
First up is Cannes Best Screenplay winner, The Substance.
Weird choice. Sorry, screenplay? Okay,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, it is a French film, and the French are kooky.
Right.
And they love themselves.
Yes. Oh, yeah. No, it's like the BAFTAs when, like, Helena Bonham Carter wins for The King's Speech. I'm like, girl, she just gave somebody a hug. You gave her a BAFTA for that?
So, did we find the film underwhelming, or will we be shouting Gimme Demi Moore?
Wow. That was 3 puns? What's happening there? Okay. I'll say this. I avoided reading about this movie beforehand because people were so, like, because the buzz on this movie was just, go see it, as opposed to look out for this thing or look out for this thing. So I went in not knowing much. I'm a little disappointed in this movie. Yes, because I guess this actually does have to do with anticipation, because people said, oh, it's 10 times more insane than Hereditary. And I don't agree with that. I think Hereditary is still a crazier movie, which that will be irrelevant to what I say in a second. I just feel like in terms of a body horror movie, we have kind of already seen this thing being obsessed with youthfulness, like male gaze, black swan, women versus women, self versus self stuff, handled with body horror. I felt like I had kind of seen this movie before.
I feel like that's the whole point of this movie, Lewis. I feel like it is definitely living in a retrograde 90s sort of era. Mm-hmm. I mean, the idea of Demi Moore sort of being jealous of a younger woman in Hollywood, with, first of all, Demi Moore is hot as fuck.
She looks spectacular.
Right. And leading a film, and sexy women in Hollywood at this point are sort of her age at this point. I feel like it is sort of a throwback to the 90s when it was, you know, someone younger and hungrier is coming down the stairs. Very showgirls, where mm-hmm. a girl who's like 19 to 21 is going to come and steal your spot. I mean, the whole idea of her doing a jazzercise TV show is very retrograde. I feel like the whole thing is meant to be a throwback. So I didn't mind any of that.
Okay, I will also just explain the movie to people who want a synopsis and don't mind being spoiled a bit. But basically, Demi Moore is this woman who is in her 50s, I guess, hosting, as Ira said, a jazzercise-like TV show, very Jane Fonda-coded.
Elizabeth Sparkle.
Yeah, her name is Elizabeth Sparkle, and she is a one-time movie star and Oscar winner, according to this movie. And eventually, and she kind of has fans, it's this like TV extravaganza, and then she is canned and they want somebody younger and prettier, and she encounters this stuff called the substance, which you can inject, and the rule is you'll get to be this younger, hotter version of yourself, or a person who's sort of connected to you, but you only get to do it for 7 days at a time, and then you have to switch bodies with that person and go back to your old self. So you only get 7 days of this young hotness before you go back to your regular self. And what happens is, and the younger self is, of course, played by Margaret Qualley, who I think is our leading Nepo baby at the moment, if I had to rank them all.
She's
Maya
everywhere.
Hoff, take notes. Yeah. She's, and also one of those people where she still feels like a brand new star to me, and I've already seen her in 8 movies. You know what I mean? Like, she, like, it's like when Jessica Chastain was in those 30 movies in the 1 year, and she was suddenly a part of culture.
I also want to say that every time she's in a different movie, I mean, maybe this is just my, like, I feel like I recognize white people, you know, I'm familiar with your game.
You're taking care, you got your handy-dandy notebook, you're taking your notes, yeah.
I pick up what you put down, you know, but every time I'm watching her in a movie, I'm sort of like, And then at the end when it says Margaret Qualley in the credits, I'm like, oh, that was her.
Yeah. She also is somebody who I think is a really versatile actress, but doesn't really look like it when you're looking at her. You're like, oh, is she just being herself? But no, she does lots of sorts of different kooky things in Poor Things, for example. But anyway, so there's Demi Moore and then this substance person who emerges, Margaret Qualley. And in the going back and forth, the Demi person gets more and more wretched, more and more resentful. She kind of hates the younger self for taking more of her time. And then the younger Margaret Qualley character starts abusing the substance, staying in this with the substance too long, which has reverberations. Anyway, it becomes this dual consciousness thing that plays out in terms of body horror later in the movie. I think also a problem, I agree, Ira, it's supposed to be a throwback in certain ways. I just felt like from the minute we see the words the substance, I know the body horror we're getting. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I know eventually this woman is going to be so decrepit, so doubled over, so a shell of her former self. And I think it's to the movie's credit that it's not going for nuance. They literally are like, the men are gross. This woman wants this one youthful potion thing, a la Death Becomes Her, and we're going to see how it plays out. That said, when it's as simple as a fairy tale or as simple as a Twilight Zone episode, I didn't feel like I got enough ingenuity otherwise to make it a thumbs up for me.
I feel like that third act gag, you know, just throwing the spoiler a bit, you know, I saw that it was going back to Demi getting a bit decrepit, but I was not seeing the bitch running back to the place and getting the accelerant again, the activation again, and then a new thing reemerging.
Mm. Yeah,
that I was not expecting, and that I felt like that entire third act with, you know, then the fun dream sequence and then the whole almost reverse carry was so much fun to me. And I thought that the movie was having so much fun in those moments, and it wasn't about logic, and you got those moments from the beginning, to be honest. I like that when, you know, Margaret Qualley is like, I don't want to look at Demi Moore lying on the carpet in the living room anymore. And she just sort of like, you cut to her with a sledgehammer building a secret room in her bathroom. And it's no explanation of how she does this.
No,
she just
they just run right into fantasy.
And yeah, it's great. And I even the other part of the fantasy of Demi Moore having to climb like down under this sort of like garage door in this hidden sort of abandoned building to get the substance in the first place. I don't know. It felt so fun and goofy and cartoonish to me that I was on board the entire time.
I think the thing is, it does have these flourishes that are comical, but I felt like they were always just short of funny. It was like, you know, just to play on, oh, isn't she desperate? This is a fairy tale gone awry. This is a Rumpelstiltskin-like curse.
The script isn't very funny. The situations are funny. I think the actors are funny. I think that the dialogue could have used a bit more of a pass, to be honest. I don't understand how it won Best Screenplay.
Yeah.
But I am on board for the whole movie in general.
The awards conversation around this, people are saying, oh, I hope Demi Moore gets a Best Actress nomination. I don't really think this role is like that. Like, she is great in the looks fabulous, is great at the role, but it's not really, it's not an emotional performance because the movie, again, is this purposely two-dimensional cartoon thing. You know, I almost would compare it to Madonna in Evita, which is to say, it's like one long music video. In fact, I think this movie would have been better as a music video or a short film or an episode of television. That's what I can say about this movie. But like, there's not enough real acting going on. Like, it's a bunch of wearing, you know, David Cronenberg-y, Rick Baker-like prosthetics, ultimately, you know.
Yeah, I mean, but that's the whole point of the cinema.
Yeah, but true. But when you're comparing that to what I'm sure, like, Nicole Kidman brings in Baby Girl, there's just no comparison for me.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, like, this is sort of like The Fly, you know? I think that, like, there's the whole point of, like, the pseudo-music video and the thing of just, like, you seeing all these sort of bracing and fun images on screen. I mean, like, I think that's the whole point, especially sort of, like, French cinema. And I love the director of this film, Coralie Faget. She's just having a fucking good-ass time. I don't know if you ever saw her film Revenge, a 2017 film.
Oh, my friends love that movie. I have not seen it.
Bonkers as hell.
And bonkers is important. And I will say, like, it's interesting to try to characterize this movie because horror is correct, but I think it's more accurate to call it a satire more than I would call it horror, ultimately. Because it's not going for jump scares. You know, no. it's gruesome. It's funny and gruesome. Yeah.
She's down to clown. She's having a good time.
Right, right. Margaret Qualley, also very good in the movie. Dennis Quaid, actually amusingly awful as the TV exec who's a monster and chewing shrimp in a very gross... If you have misophonia, that thing where you can't listen to people chew, don't watch this movie.
I also just loved the fact that they just kept calling for a while Margaret Qualley's new thing, new show. That was funny to me. And then when she was on the talk show, the show.
The funniest part of the movie to me is when she's filming this stupid show where she's just doing aerobics on television and zooming in on her ass. There's a part where the substance reacts and you see like something jolt out of her skin. And then the male producer is like, hold on, we need to watch that back. Someone saw something bizarre. Just, that was funny. Like that play on like male gaziness, that almost ran into something a little... innovative to me, but it sort of shied away from that. Ultimately, it was really just about I'm a woman in Hollywood, and now I'm a mess.
I really enjoyed it. I felt like there were a bit more sort of maybe nuances that the film was missing. Obviously, there were, you know, some things that maybe would have been thrown in to make it more logical, but the film wasn't really caring about logic, so who gives a fuck? But, yeah. I mean, case in point, there's a moment where she runs into at the diner someone else who's on the substance, and that's a helpful moment to sort of ground the film in the fact of, you know, other people are using it. But my other question, too, was she's in Hollywood, right? Like, how much does this shit cost? And if you're in Hollywood and you're surrounded by these execs and these people watching the TV show, et cetera, right? If it is a metaphor for Ozempic and sort of like plastic surgery and sort of where our body and image culture is right now, right? Mm-hmm. Would there not be other people in the industry on the substance? She's number 503.
That's true. Like, it would be clear in a way to the other people in this movie what was going on. You know, like they play like she it only is happening to her, the substance, or that there's a secret network of people who are like distributing this to her. But obviously it's not that secret. So yeah, that's just not something that's important to the movie, like these these credibility gaps. But that's a good point.
Yeah. I mean, that's a completely different movie, though. You know, if there's like multiple people vanishing for weeks at a time, you know?
But yeah.
This is just focused on Demi. And for what it was, I had a really fucking good time. And will I see it again? I don't know.
Yeah. Here, one last problem with this movie. So the hot Margaret Qualley character becomes a rating sensation. And then she's told she gets to host the end of year, the New Year's special or whatever. And at that moment, I had an idea for a comedy beat. And I was like, I hope this happens. I wanted her to be a decrepit monster who then growls into the microphone, Happy New Year. But she didn't do it. They didn't do anything with the New Year's thing. I think that would have been funny.
Yeah. Well, they tried.
Thank you. Yes. No, I mean, like, again, I appreciate the gusto. Fell short for me.
Yeah. Really just made it more of a joke pass.
I think so, too. Yeah. It wanted to be funny. It wanted to be funny.
It did. Because even the scene of... There's a scene where Margaret Qualley has to run to the bathroom because she's having a substance reaction. And there's this hot guy that she's in bed with who gets up and goes to the bathroom. And it's just a very simple, oh, are you having lady problems, like, thing. And like, that scene could have been so much funnier.
Agreed. Right. Like, that they could have had three more jokes right there as opposed to that one sort of expected joke from the dumbass guy lingering.
The funniest running bit was the neighbor, though.
Oh, yes. And he played that really well. She has this pervy neighbor who's like, who sees her get hot and then suddenly is stalking her and but doing it happily. Like, she should be so happy that he's there.
Yeah. Anyway, I think that it is definitely fucking worth seeing. So.
Yeah, come back and scream at me. You know how I love a little rowdiness in the comments.
All right, when we're back, keep it.
Question. Are you politically engaged and spiritually exhausted?
If you said yes to both, welcome home. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
And we're the hosts of Hysteria, the podcast for women who care about democracy, culture, and not losing their minds in the process.
We break down the news, call out the nonsense, and spotlight the women actually fighting back on Capitol Hill, in classrooms, and everywhere the stakes are high.
It's sharp, honest analysis featuring women's voices with humor and zero hand-holding.
Listen to Hysteria wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube. Quick question. Are you politically engaged and spiritually exhausted?
If you said yes to both, welcome home. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
And we're the hosts of Hysteria, the podcast for women who care about democracy, culture, and not losing their minds in the process.
We break down the news, call out the nonsense, and spotlight the women actually fighting back on Capitol Hill, in classrooms, and everywhere the stakes are high.
It's sharp, honest analysis featuring women's voices with humor and zero hand-holding.
Listen to Hysteria wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube.
And And we are back with our favorite segment of the episode, but it's not this week.
No, not for a second. Sorry. Speaking of gruesome, it continues. Yeah.
I am so unexcited about my Keep It this week.
The ugliest yet. We used to have a board of stars behind us on Keep It, like a collage, and I believe she was one of them. So this is tough. Yeah.
Yeah. Why don't we just start with mine this week? Mine is Janet Jackson, unfortunately.
One of the greatest celebrities we'll ever have. Yes.
Truly. She was asked in an interview with The Guardian recently, which, first of all, why is Janet doing interviews?
This is the beginning of the issue, because she was the queen of not giving an interview for a while, and I didn't know that there was a reason why, and now we know there's a reason why.
Yeah. So she was asked about America potentially voting in its first black female president.
Mm-hmm. What could go wrong?
Sure. But this is a question that Essence should be asking her, by the way. The Guardian, what are we doing here?
Yeah, tough.
Well, you know what? They supposedly said she's not black. That's what I heard. That she's Indian. Her father's white. That's what I was told. I mean, I haven't watched the news in a few days. I was told they discovered her father was white. I don't know. Honestly, I don't want to answer that because I really, truthfully don't know. I think either way it goes, it's going to be mayhem.
First of all, if you didn't know this, Janet Jackson is a cross between Marilyn Monroe and Venus Extravaganza from Paris. Second of all, first of all, my absolute favorite part of the quote, which is, by the way, an atrocious quote, is I haven't seen the news in a couple days, as if maybe it changed since then, since I got my intel. It is so nonsense. I mean, like, I'm sure a lot of us had the same reaction where it's illuminating in that way where you're like, some people are getting their knowledge, the knowledge, if you will, Janet fans, from things you would never even anticipate. Like, Janet Jackson, somebody who seems like a cool, we're used to rooting for Janet Jackson, like the Justin Timberlake saga. We instinctively connect with Janet Jackson. Mm-hmm. And yet I look at this and I'm like, this is somebody I have never met before.
Yeah. So, obviously, we've heard this shit before from Donald Trump. Harris's father, Donald Harris, is Jamaican. He's a Stanford professor, and he split from her Indian mother when she was 5. There's been a lot of back and forth about her racial makeup, obviously, because she's mixed, and it's really just sort of a sequel to the Obama birther bullshit.
Right. I mean, it's like borderline the same verbiage, actually. Yeah.
But wait, there's more. Amid the backlash, BuzzFeed spoke to Mo El-Masri, a man who claimed to be her manager and is credited as a producer on her upcoming documentary. Maybe that's why she's giving interviews. This is a documentary. Okay.
Yeah, giving it a shot.
Yeah. He has given statements about Janet in the past, by the way.
Okay.
So in a statement to BuzzFeed, he said, Janet Jackson would like to clarify her recent comments. She recognizes her statements regarding Vice President Kamala Harris's racial identity were based on misinformation. Janet respects Harris's dual heritage as both Black and Indian and apologizes for any confusion caused. She values the diversity Harris represents and understands the importance of celebrating that in today's society. Janet remains committed to promoting unity and understanding. Okay, the Rhythm Nation's back intact.
They're intact. Right? Yes, right. We're all back in our black hats and our militaristic garb.
But then Janet's reps subsequently told Variety that the apology was made by a person who was not the singer's manager, as he had claimed, and thus was not authorized to speak on her behalf.
So they just decided, can you just let us make this as worse as possible? Thank you. This is our whole thing right now.
Mo then told Variety via email, I no longer work for her. I was fired by Janet and Randy Jackson, her brother, after attempts to improve her image in front of public opinion and her fans, and this is something I do not deserve.
One of the messiest moments in recent pop culture history.
Wow.
And also, Randy Jackson, the one we just named, is apparently deeply QAnon affiliated. you know what? Maybe there are members of the Jackson family who can be wrong from time to time. I don't know. There's no precedent for it in human history. So,
oh, you mean LaToya when she said faggot on TV that time?
She absolutely can say that. Excuse me.
Wow. This so is... tough.
By the way, I was all excited to see Janet Jackson because she's doing like a Vegas residency, which we sort of were clued into because she went and saw Kylie's. And so we were like anticipating it even then. And then she signed up to do it. Like, I think she'll be doing New Year's shows. And now, in good conscience, can I go see that show? I mean, I was so looking forward to it.
I mean, yes. But...
If she does Throb, I've got to be there. I've got to be there.
At the end of the day, yes. But what I will say is wild about this statement is not that Janet said it. I mean, it shocked me, obviously, that she said it. But being under the influence of Randy Jackson, obviously, her brain's been twisted. Or maybe she's just felt this way for a while. I don't know. You know, maybe she's also a closet Republican. Who can say what is really going on in the House of Jackson? Okay?
Right.
We haven't really known what's ever going on with that family ever, you know?
Correct. You're right. All the glimpses we've had is like projection and guessing and stuff. We don't know anything personally about a lot of these people. Correct. Rebe, I hope you're well.
Even when we say we know things about, say, like Beyonce or Rihanna and stuff, like we know more about them than we do about the Jacksons. Because they came up in the era, at least where they were doling out information to the public through the tabloids or through interviews in the way that they wanted to, you know? They came up pre-TMZ. We don't really know the Jackson family. But what shocked me about the response to this is, now, you know, amidst all of the Michael drama, the way that people who are Michael stans defend him online constantly, you know, like in insane ways.
Certainly. The most insane fans who ever lived. Yes.
Now, I was not prepared for those same people to be coming out for Janet. But of course, right?
Right. Yeah.
So you have people in comments basically arguing in defense of Janet's comments about Kamala Harris, because they are so deeply entrenched in defending the Jackson family.
Which, I mean, these don't strike me as, you know, political science minded people. So I feel like, you know, like stepping where they don't really have the range to step. Also, just like, so your whole angle is you love the Jackson, so you're now going to be racist. Okay, strange. Yeah. Doesn't really fit.
What happened to doesn't matter if you're black or white or Indian?
Please. Right. Which is, by the way, I just want to say quickly.
Well, the song didn't say that, by the way. Yeah, it didn't say Indian. That was the problem.
He wasn't specific enough. Yes, he made it a binary, which we don't believe in. There's a Siskel and Ebert episode where they get into the black or white video. Look it up. It's crazy how wrong they are. They watch the video and everything they say, I'm like, do we not watch the same thing? Anyway, moving on. Yeah, it's been a really difficult week. I root for Janet Jackson, and I root for her also to give interviews. So when we get this moment, that's just this unguarded. Also, it's unusually unguarded for her. You're telling me she just said that to a reporter? Like, or it feels like something that look. I'm sure she said it the way she said it, and I'm assuming the reporter logged it in good faith. It feels like something you say when you think somebody isn't recording. I'm shocked.
Yeah, you know what I'm wondering? Michael Jackson fans release doves at the courthouse.
Yeah, oh no.
Are Janet stans going to be releasing black cats at the White House?
Smart, one of her best.
It's just cats meowing around the White House grounds, which, given the current situation with J.D. Vance and the lies about Haitians, might cause some trouble.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, also, I mean, I was just hearing recently that Diddy's streaming is up at the moment. Like, people maybe remembered him and looked up the songs. And I'm not comparing Janet Jackson to Diddy in any way. But if she does release Black Cats all over the White House, and then people go and listen to that song, it might have been worth it, is all I'm saying. If Black Cat were the next murder on the dance floor that I heard all the time, wouldn't hate it. Come on, WeHo Pride, let's go.
By the way, that is such a more insidious thing than even sort of like R. Kelly, right? The Diddy thing, because Diddy has so many either remixes or features of things where he just wormed his annoying ass onto songs that when we listened to them in the first place, I wasn't listening to All About the Benjamins to hear Diddy. I was listening to it to hear Lil' Kim's verse. You know, like Diddy is on so many fucking songs that I do not like. I turn it off when it's his verse in the first place. Like, Tell Me with Christina Aguilera. Like, I don't want to hear him saying, "Let's play a game." I'm like, I want to hear Christina Aguilera wailing. It's so fucking annoying that he's like wormed his way into the trenches of so many people's songs that you just really can't cut him out of it.
He was sort of immediately supplanted by Snoop Dogg in that way, where it's just like every fifth song on the charts involved him. But before that, it was Diddy. So good luck avoiding him, even though you probably think you are. He is basically 1990s and 2000s pop culture personified. So,
well, I mean, also, I bet Jessie Nelson, remember her? Is glad that one single of hers flopped so hard that no one remembers it. The one that sampled Bad Boy for Life so hard.
Yes.
Imagine if that was her only song and it was a hit and then she couldn't perform it anymore.
Well, the politics beat is not over today because we're going to get to my keep it, which is to the otherwise delightful Chapel Roan, whose album I think everybody is now finally on board with. I was like a latecomer. Ira and I've talked about this in recent weeks. Super Graphic Ultra Modern Girl, a smash. My Kink is Karma, a smash. Actually, her interviews, generally speaking, a smash. And then, recently, in an interview with the, you guessed it, Guardian, Chapel Roan was
What's
asked
going
about,
on over there?
They are cooking up something. Eye of Newt, like, it's all going into the cauldron. She was asked if she would support Kamala Harris. And she said, I have so many issues with our government in every way. There are so many things that I would want to change, so I don't feel pressured to endorse someone. There's problems on both sides. I encourage people to use your critical thinking skills, use your vote, vote small, vote for what's going on in your city. I have friends who say things like, she's young, why are we expecting this young pop star who became famous yesterday to say all the right things? It's not all the right things. It's one thing. Say don't vote for fucking Donald Trump. You can't be touting the trans community. You can't be touting drag culture. Communities that are so directly affected by this fucking loser. Without saying, absolutely don't vote for him. There is a difference. The word's both sides. Take in popular culture for 2 seconds. We simply don't say that anymore, unless we're referencing the hits of Joni Mitchell, in which case, put on both sides now. It's her best song. Otherwise, maybe she'll retract this or say something in the future. Obviously, I have been on board with everything Chapel Roan has done up until this point. I love screaming that fans are disgusting, as you know. Once upon a time when people would go up to Madonna and she'd say, get away from me, and like hit him with their fur coat or something. I love that shit.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I will say that I'm less angry at her, and I'm going to get into this, than I am at some very specific thing that seems to be going on the internet. And that is all of these websites, like this particularly came from a internet account called PopFlop, which is every single account now seems to be trying to copy Pop Crave.
Right. Which is a sensation, but at the same time, just a Twitter account. So like, is it money making? Why are we copying it anyway?
So it's PopFlop and it's a verified Twitter account. So I guess they're trying to make money off of impressions. And this quote was initially not even credited to the interview. And what people also don't even realize is this first interview, this first quote about politics was said immediately after the Donald Trump and Biden debate.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not even a recent interview. What happens is these internet accounts now, because every fucking day we are inundated with a new quote from Chapel Roan reveals, or like she has like talks about she has depression or whatever. And I feel like each fucking day it's just easy for one of these things to just like, you just pull a new quote from an old Chapel Roan thing.
Yeah, right.
You put it out and it's the internet is going to talk about it all day.
Mm-hmm.
That's all you have to do. you know? And I think it's fucking annoying to do to her. I think it's, like, annoying to do to us. And I think that she could have chosen her words better. I think that when you get into sort of what she said before, the fact that, like, she wanted, she, the reason why she didn't perform at the White House is because she wanted to sort of read Palestinian poetry, but her team told her that that wouldn't be right, that probably wouldn't be safe for her to do.
And she also said she didn't want to be a monkey for pride, which I actually respect specifically that verbiage. That
yes.
is, like, kind of cool.
Yeah. And she has said specifically, you know, that trans rights is very important to her and they cannot have cis people making decisions for trans people, period. As she has said since Kamala became the nominee, that she's lucky to be alive where we have sort of a historical Black female nominee for president. You know, I think it's not unreasonable for someone who's 26 and who supports Palestine to be very upset with the government that is sending arms to Israel.
No, but by all means, please.
But I think, that specifically.
Yeah.
And I think it's hard because specifically saying the words, there's problems on both sides, will make people think that you're saying both sides are the same. I mean, right. There are problems on both sides, but I think you need to specifically say, not because people will be like, you're saying both the same, because that that reminds us of Trump saying, you know, there's very fine people on both sides, you know?
Right, right. And I mean, like, and of course, there's no reason to compare her to him, et cetera. Yeah, just being explicit about that point, like the genocide thing, weighs heavily on me. And by the way, everybody.
Yeah.
So, I'm sorry, not everybody.
Well, no. I will also say not everybody, because I also feel like there is that thing too of any criticism of Kamala at this point, because we're getting so much closer to the election, you're accused of being a Republican online now, which is crazy, because she is out here talking about how much Dick Cheney loves her every other day. So who's really being Republican?
Well, also, I just feel like in general, there's a sentiment about voting for somebody where, because we're in, you know, we're inundated sort of stan culture, if you're voting for someone, that means, like, you're, like, fucking obsessed with everything about them. Like, don't be illusioned. Like, voting for someone is what's the best path forward. Like, it's about a whole administration, just whatever. So I feel like there's a lot of sentiment out there just being, like, if you're saying you're voting for her, you're being rah-rah. When I don't think you have to be, so.
Which I think that is exactly why she is not endorsing Kamala and is instead being like, you can vote for her. And I think that a lot of celebrities actually should not be endorsing a political candidate. If you're a Taylor Swift or Beyonce and you have, and like you're the biggest fucking celebrity in the world, sure, you know? But a lot of people forget that an endorsement is bigger than voting. Voting means, you know, you are making up your mind at the ballot that this is just sort of the best decision for you, you know? But an endorsement sort of means that you are a, like, full-throated endorse all of their policies, you know?
Mm. Or you may have to answer later for
means you have to answer later for shit when you do that endorsement. Case in point, politicians all the time, you know? You endorse something. I mean, maybe pop stars don't really have to deal with that, but you endorse any sort of politician, and then next time you're running for office or you're interviewed or something, it's like, well, you endorse this person, and remember when they voted for the war in Iraq? And it's like, endorsing that.
I want to say my last sort of empathetic thing about this is maybe she was asked the question sort of in a surprise way or offhandedly or something. And so in that moment, maybe just not prepared to answer it well, which is always something you have to think about when you get these random sound bites. Like, what is the actual occasion of the interview? What is the person asking? Because, like, if it's not a full GQ spread or Rolling Stone article, you know, it's pretty strange. Like, did they get one question on a red carpet where they were breezing by? You know, you never actually know the physical context of what's happening, too. So I'm not saying that's an excuse for anybody, but something to think about.
But also bring back, that's why you also want to bring back, like, MTV News or something, you know? Because I also think that Chappell is a funny and sort of sarcastic and sort of sassy, dry-witted lesbian. And you sort of can't read her tone in a lot of these quotes that just get parsed online all the time. Like, people always say she complains about everything. Like, when that quote came out about her making fun of Hailey Bieber's Erewhon smoothie. Yeah, she's like, this isn't a smoothie, it's a milkshake. But I'm like, if you heard her saying it in the interview, her tone would probably not come across as complaining. It would come across as you joking with your friends, being like, this ain't a smoothie, it's a milkshake.
I just want to say, by the way, I had three girlfriends in from my hometown last weekend, and nothing could have deterred them from getting that fucking shake. So I'm sorry. People are still obsessed, no matter what. I did not. No, I actually don't even know what's in it. And I love that. I love a milkshake and all Khalees culture.
Well, Lewis, I will tell you exactly what's in Hailey Bieber's strawberry glaze skin smoothie.
Oh, bone chilling. Okay.
I mean, it sounds like something in Mrs. Lovett's meat shop, for one.
And by Mrs. Lovett, we don't mean John. Yes.
The full ingredients are mock organic almond milk, organic banana, organic strawberries, organic avocado, organic dates, organic maple syrup, vital proteins, vanilla collagen, vanilla stevia, sea moss, Zuma Valley organic coconut cream, Driscoll's organic strawberry glaze. Yeah, baby, that's a milkshake.
Babe, it's also every ingredient. I mean, it's, I remember when you would put milk and strawberries together. That was it? Yeah, no, that's definitely a milkshake. But it's like $17 or something. So yeah, that makes sense.
Maple syrup and vanilla and dates and banana and milk. It's what are we doing here?
Maple syrup. That is a bit much. Okay. Anyway, I'm going to actually definitely get it. So I'll report back and tell you.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's our episode this week. We covered
a lot. It was
a
little zany, but yeah, it was, everything was so urgent. You know, it was like an all hands on deck E! News situation, you know, where they bring in Jules Asner and she's like sitting down at the table and it looks like the war room from Dr. Strangelove.
Wasn't it sort of thematic for us to bring Lovett in and then kick him out immediately?
Within 8 minutes, yeah. No, great. I just want to, before we go, tout Jeff Probst on Rock and Roll Jeopardy. Look up old episodes of that. That was what he did immediately before Survivor. Mm. Fabulous host. Fabulous host. Fabulous show.
Rock and Roll Jeopardy. Was it just music?
Yes, it was VH1. And they had celebrity episodes too. But I mean, for someone like you, you wouldn't miss a question. There was a place for us once upon a time. And there will be again when Pop Culture Jeopardy premieres in December. I watched all the episodes. I wrote on it. You'll love it.
Look at you getting that promo in.
I know. And I want that second Emmy nomination. That's why.
Also, look at me. I finally have advanced reader copies.
Oh my God. I don't have one in my hands.
I'm going to mail one. To Crooked. Okay. Yes. So, but anyway.
I don't live at Crooked, so send
it to
me.
I'll mail one to you. But yeah, we have these. So, go ahead and pre-order one, kids. And I'm recording.
And a Hailey Bieber shake, yes.
Yeah, and a Hailey Bieber.
They really should come together. They really should come together.
A free Hailey Bieber shake along with a book. Can you imagine? Hailey Bieber, actually, do promo for us on the show. Come on, keep it.
Yeah, what are you doing? Just come on over.
Yeah. Anyway, we will see you next week. Don't forget to follow Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok.
You can also subscribe to Keep It on YouTube for access to full episodes and other exclusive content. And if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a review.
Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our producers are Chris Lord and Kennedy Hill. Our executive producers are Ira Madison III, Louis Vertel, and Kendra James.
Our digital team is Megan Patzel, Claudia Sheng, and Rachel Gajewski. This episode was recorded and mixed by Evan Sutton. Thank you to Matt DeGroat, David Tolles, Kyle Seglin, and Charlotte Landis for production support every week.
Question. Are you politically engaged and spiritually exhausted?
If you said yes to both, welcome home. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
And we're the hosts of Hysteria, the podcast for women who care about democracy, culture, and not losing their minds in the process.
We break down the news, call out the nonsense, and spotlight the women actually fighting back on Capitol Hill, in classrooms, and everywhere the stakes are high.
It's sharp, honest analysis featuring women's voices with humor and zero hand-holding.
Listen to Hysteria wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube.